It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi. And by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Like not to kill, not to steal, or the subtler and more personal way that it's expressed in the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony, not to take what is not given, is a way of living that naturally arises from our Buddha nature. But if we are deluded, and deluded means to think that mind and object are separate, or that self and other have independent existence, that's what deluded means, then it's quite natural and unavoidable to steal. Rev Anderson Roshi says, when we are deluded, stealing cannot be stopped. When we awaken, we cannot be forced to steal. The title of this talk, "You Mean It's Not Okay to Steal?" Are the words of a now Zen priest, former hippie living with a bunch of other hippies in a communal house where stealing food was how they ate. No one gave a second thought. When she found herself at the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony somehow, landing there, she was shocked to learn that there was anything the matter with it. "You mean it's not okay to steal?" Came right out of her lifestyle with many others who never once questioned its validity. This is what the line, "when we are deluded, stealing is quite natural and unavoidable," means. Everyone does it. What's the problem? I did it. As a little girl in the dime store, I stole, I can't remember what it was, but I never got caught and I never considered anything beyond how happy I was to have it. And later, when I was about 10 or 11, this was a really pivotal moment, actually. My mother took me with her to a department store. And while I was hanging around waiting for her to pay, I saw her steal, basically. I saw her slip something that she wasn't paying for into this large black shop, this kind of leather bag she was carrying. And my heart stopped. I felt hot and ashamed and worried about what I was going to do when we got home. You'd think that from there, I would be sure of the wrongness, but I wasn't. As a student, I stole food. And once I got caught and taken to the back room, and there were police, though I did stop after that, I didn't get that it was wrong. I think wanting the thing so overpowered my view that I didn't give a thought either to the spiritual repercussions for me or for how it would be for the unfortunate shopkeeper. In one sutra, this is a sutra of the biography of the Buddha, it says, if you commit one of the five deadly sins, and the five deadly sins are killing your father, killing your mother, killing an arhat, shedding the blood of a Buddha, or creating a schism in the Sangha, you can be saved. If you do one of those things, you can still be saved. But that is saved from suffering. Saved always means saved from suffering. But if you steal Sangha property, you cannot be saved. In another scripture, it says, if the stealing mind cannot be removed, the dusts of the sensual world cannot be left behind. It means that if one has not gotten rid of the mind of stealing, it is certain one will fall into what is called evil destinies. Approaching this precept from a conventional perspective, we try not to steal anything. In fact, we use extreme care in all of our dealings not to take anything that is not rightfully intended for us, and we don't encourage or support others to do so either. A long time ago, I was in a shop that sold herbs and ointments and salves and things like that. And when I got home, there was something in my bag, like a cream or something that I didn't recognize and hadn't purchased. But it was like a sample size, and if it were just me, I would have just tossed it. But instead, I asked my husband what I should do. And he immediately said, well, you have to go back and return it. So, of course, that's what I did. But I noticed the difference in our responses. And I thought, that's a leftover. I felt stealing was in my nervous system. And because of that, I determined to be exhaustively vigilant. But outwardly, I am in my mind. Outwardly, I am. But in my mind, I sometimes, like on the sidewalk, there'll be something on the sidewalk, and instinctively, I'll think to pick it up. Like, I don't even know what it is, and I certainly don't want it. But what is it? Yeah, I'm not even sure. What is it that instinct to, oh, I'll take that? It's of course I don't, but it's troublesome and even more troublesome now that I know that thought and deed, karmically speaking, are the same. If you think something in your mind, it's the same as actually doing it, karmically speaking. In something called the Commentary on the Perfection of Wisdom, it tells us, Gavampati took a grain of rice to see if it was ripe. It could not be returned to its original place on the stalk. Because he committed this action, he was born as a cow for 500 generations. It must have been a Sangha field, and he took something from the Sangha. But our actions are causes, and they do have results. But even aside from the punishment, we want to be sensitive and kind and gentle in all of our relationships, just because. Here are 12 motivators for stealing as we know it in the conventional sense. I'm sure there are many more. So one is greed, like as witnessed above. The second is anger or resentment, like you might feel maligned by someone and steal something of theirs just to get back to them. But in this case, there's stealing, ill will, deceit, and praising others, praising yourself at the expense of others. So it compounds the karmic gravity enormously. The third one is convenience. Like professional movers, for example, have a reputation of picking something off the pile of their clients' belongings just because it's there and they see it and, oh, I'll have that. Convenience is the third one. The fourth is presumption, using something of someone else's without permission. Carelessness, borrowing something and not returning it, is five. Six is laziness or unwillingness to keep track of small details or to follow an interaction all the way through, which is stealing goodwill or the other's good impression of you, which they might cherish. Inconsiderateness, like being late, is stealing someone else's time. Saying you'll call back and disappearing instead while they mentally wait for you. That's seven, that's inconsiderateness. Eight is failing to acknowledge help that's been given you or work that's been done for you. It can be stealing credit that belongs to someone else. Nine is taking advantage or even creating a lack of clarity or haziness around what is expected in large or small agreements. Can be stealing from another's trust. 10 is agreeing to something that you already know you'll not do. So it takes something from the other's energy, time, and intentions. And like number 11, it borders on deceit. 11 is taking what is not wholeheartedly given, like sneaking something for yourself under the rubric of not understanding. And finally, stealing life. It's August and the fire season in California, and the trees and shrubs are like tinder. In a small eucalyptus forest near where I live, I watched a mother deer try to find but fail to find something to eat. The next day she tried again, and she laid down in a spot she had dug out for herself. And the next day she laid down again, and then she got up, and then she laid down again, licking herself while she curling up in her spot and becoming very small. I just closed my eyes and cried. I just began to cry. I am so responsible. I am so utterly responsible, not only for taking the life of this deer and her children, who will also certainly die, but the lives of the birds and butterflies and squirrels who no longer come here, and the forest, which itself no longer can support their lives. I felt so responsible. And right then, I wanted to do Zazen forever, to sit down and not harm a single thing in the world. When you consider the precept not to steal or not to take what is not given, through the lens of our relationships with both things and beings, it is easy to see our stealing mind seeping through everything and how meticulous we must be in all of our thoughts and behaviors and interactions. Alexander, of the Alexander technique used by musicians and artists and dancers, he writes, "It is what man does that brings the wrong thing about, first within himself and then in his activities in the outside world. And it is only by preventing this doing that he can ever begin to make any real change. In other words, before man can make the changes necessary in the outside world, he must learn to know the kind of doing he should prevent in himself and the how, capitalized H-O-W, how of preventing it. Change must begin in his own behavior. That's the quote from Alexander. He was primarily referring to the use of one's body. But Marcus Aurelius, I think a student of his, maybe not in actuality, in talking about our opinions and our thoughts, says that deeply entangled in our muscles, our bones and cells, and I would add in our nerves and tissues, our opinions and thoughts are embedded there. Our opinions and thoughts are deeply entangled in our muscles, our bones, our nerves, our cells and tissues. Like the Buddha, he wonders how we can differentiate between ones that are appropriate and ones that are inappropriate. When you add to that, that eighth level of consciousness, the Alaya, the storehouse of our collective karmic consciousness from this and even previous lifetimes, it makes our job both more difficult and more essential. How to undo the unwholesome and replace it with the wholesome for the remainder of our lives is part of what the Bodhisattva precepts are discussing. By the way, this series is celebrating the 16 great Bodhisattva precepts to give you a feeling for living by vow. But laymen also have precepts. There are five, all of which are included in the 10 grave precepts we are currently studying. But this is... this is something that is available to everyone. You don't have to have a special initiation ceremony. The five lay precepts are not to kill, not to take what is not given, not to misuse sexuality, refrain from wrong speech, and refrain from intoxicants that cloud the mind. That means drugs and alcohol. Next week, I'm going to talk more about living by vow in general and how it can utterly change your situation in the world. It's extremely powerful. And I'm going to talk maybe even for half the time next week, just backstepping for a minute about what are we doing in discussing these precepts and vows. So switching gears here to the kind of ultimate view, the precepts are actually unique among religious ethical teachings. They're unique among all religious ethical teachings in that they are based on the experience of no self. And that experience makes all the difference. Reb Anderson Roshi says, the great Bodhisattva precept of not stealing continues and extends the practice of the first grave precept, not killing, because the first grave precept is ultimately an appreciation of the oneness of life, of all life and a meditation on the dependent co-arising of life and death. The ultimate meaning of the second grave precept is realized by clearly observing the suchness of mind and its objects. Suchness, by the way, is a word like thusness or oneness that tries to describe the reality behind our usual perceptions. So basically what Reb is saying here is that the first precept is talking about the oneness of mind and beings, and the second precept is talking about the oneness of mind and objects. What is the suchness of mind and objects? It's the interdependence of mind and objects. Objects are anything in the entire universe of experience, not only material objects, but thoughts, feelings, and memories as well. In this context, mind is consciousness, which dependently arises together with objects. Therefore, mind and objects have no independent existence. They exist only codependently and cooperatively. If we continue to be upright, even in circumstances where pain and anxiety are present, Anderson Roshi says that eventually the separation between self and other, mind and object, is revealed as insubstantial and ungraspable. Dogen says then that the gate of liberation is opened. Mind is not enlightenment. Objects are not enlightenment, but enlightenment appears in the suchness of mind and objects. That is the oneness of them. And we hardly think this way. Self is not enlightenment. Other is not enlightenment, but enlightenment appears in the suchness of self and other. When you are fulfilled in this way, this is Reb talking. When you are fulfilled in this way, you no longer yearn for external objects, and the precept of not stealing is accomplished. For those who wish to practice and realize this great bodhisattva precept of not stealing, he says there is an authentic and unsurpassable path offered by the Buddha ancestors of the Zen tradition. It is simply to sit, stand, walk, and even recline with a complete gentleness and uprightness in the midst of all other beings. I'm going to repeat that. For those who wish to practice and realize this great bodhisattva precept of not stealing, there is an authentic and unsurpassable path offered by the Buddha ancestors of the Zen tradition. It is simply to sit, stand, walk, and even recline with the complete gentleness and uprightness in the midst of all other beings. Then he tells this wonderful story of the Zen monk poet Ryokan. I used to idolize Ryokan's poetry. And Ryokan lived in a little hut on a mountainside. One full moon night, a thief came to visit. And Ryokan wasn't home, so the thief entered, but he didn't find anything to steal. So Ryokan returned, and seeing the thief, he said, "Oh, I'm sorry that you came all this way and you didn't get anything. Here, take my clothes." After he left, Ryokan, standing naked in the moonlight, cried out, "Poor fellow, he didn't get much. I wish I could give him this full moon too." I actually heard another version of the story where Ryokan goes running after the thief. "Wait, please, here's something else you can take." Reb says that he was initially attracted to Zen through this story. This is what first attracted him to Zen. He says, "I was a thief and Ryokan showed me the precept of not stealing. With open eyes, I glimpsed the inconceivable beauty of Ryokan's heart and the suchness of mind and objects. At that time, I felt great affinity with Ryokan, and I wondered how my heart could be more like his. Now I trust that being upright is the gate to Ryokan's heart. Now I trust that being upright is the gate to Ryokan's heart." Here are the most important points from the talk today. First, there is an authentic and unsurpassable path. Authentic and unsurpassable path offered by the Buddha ancestors of the Zen tradition. And it is simply to sit, stand, walk, and even recline with complete gentleness and uprightness in the midst of all other beings. Second, mind is not enlightenment, objects are not enlightenment. Enlightenment appears in the suchness or oneness of mind and objects. Self is not enlightenment, other is not enlightenment. Enlightenment appears in the suchness our oneness of self and other. Third, before man can make changes necessary in the outside world, he must learn to know a kind of doing, the kind of doing that he should prevent in himself, and the how of preventing it. Change must begin in his own behavior. Fourth, that Zazen is a way of not harming a single thing in the world. And finally, Reb's words, "I was a thief and Ryokan showed me the precept of not stealing. With open eyes, I glimpsed the inconceivable beauty of Ryokan's heart and the suchness of mind and objects. At that time, I felt great affinity with Ryokan, and I wondered how my heart could be more like his. Now I trust that being upright is the gate to Ryokan's heart." And now I want to suggest that you, in the upcoming week, you think about or write about these ideas associated with the second grave precept, not to steal or not to take what is not given. So first, just review in your mind this talk and pick out some points that really stuck out for you. Just even little things that just resonated for you, and try to capture those. That's the first place to start. And then secondly, in the Ryokan story, Ryokan was sorry that the thief hardly got anything, and he wished he could give him the full moon too. But when you think about it, the thief already had the full moon. The full moon was shining on the thief, just like it was on Ryokan. So what do you think Ryokan meant? What do you think he meant? Third, to review your own life closely. What have you stolen? And what is the main motivator for your stealing? Do you still steal? And what might be a plan for ridding yourself of the stealing mind? Fourthly, do you notice any patterns around your stealing or around the kinds of stealing that you do? If so, you can use these to pre-warn yourself of a situation that might be dangerous for you or for your choices that you need to think extra carefully about. And fifth, why do you think that, as the sutra says, that stealing Sangha property like a grain of rice is worse than killing your father, mother, arhat, shedding the blood of a Buddha, or dividing the Sangha, creating a division in the Sangha? How could this be? How could it be? Do you have any questions?
Yes, Gail. So the first question that we have is, hello, Gail. Thank you so much for these teachings. Every week, there is so much to inspire and give pause for thought. And I'm very grateful for your generosity with the Dharma. I did want to clarify one thing you said tonight about the karmic consequences of thought and action. I thought that a complete karmic consequence was not only about the thought / violation, but also action and satisfaction, completion. Please, could you say a bit more about the thought and action having the same karmic consequence? Particularly when I think about thoughts without a thinker and thoughts just being part of the ocean of mind stream. There has to be a difference between thought and action. Is there not?
I know I had the same taken aback feeling or thought myself. The argument about, you know, thought actually doesn't exist, and also as we know, in either the absolute truth is there is no stealer, there's no person stealing from, and there's no stealing. I mean, it's impossible to steal. So that said, though, we're talking on a different level. About your question, I think, is on a different level about how could it be that the thought of stealing and the action have the same karmic consequences? And I wonder also, having studied karma pretty pretty serious. I studied it a lot in the many years I spent as a Tibetan Buddhist. And it's the karma of any action. There's all kinds of levels to it. So like there's maybe 25 levels to the, I'm exaggerating, but if your intentions make a big difference in the karma, if you actually harm the person more than you intended, if other people are involved, there's all kinds of ways that and karma is decided, so to speak, as if there's a decider. And to me, it would seem just like you're saying that the thought and that the thought would be, you thought it, but you didn't do it. How could that be the same as if you did it? But I've read that again and again. That's all I can say. I've read it again and again, that it's the same karmic consequence. And also, you probably noticed in my talk today, using this expression, the mind of stealing. One of the first things I said is, I was reading this quote. If the stealing mind cannot be removed, the dust of the sensual world cannot be left behind. So you're just going to be here forever, basically. Like Gavampati, who was reborn as a cow for five generations, for how many generations? 500 generations. The upshot is, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm sorry. That's the upshot.
So the next question we have is, Gail, please, could you say more about purification and remorse, which you also discussed last week? Listening to the elements of what stealing entails, and like your story with the deer, I'm forced to confront how impossible not stealing is. Does the forms and ceremonies precept cover this consistent practice of regret? And where does this antidote for existence, for lack of a better word, fit in?
I think that remorse is extremely important. And we did talk last week, and we can just talk forever because it's so important, about repentance. Because that's a different mind. That's the mind of not stealing. That's the mind of, how can my heart be like Ryokan's heart? How can I make my heart as totally wide open to all beings as Ryokan did? And that, I think that remorse inspires, well, in me, it inspired wanting to do zazen, because that was one activity that didn't harm a single being. I think in the studies that I did in Tibetan Buddhism about precepts and breaking a precept, in terms of karma, remorse enormously lessens the karmic consequences of an action that has negative karmic consequences. It's a huge antidote. And I think that's why in all Buddhist temples, usually twice a month, there's the repentance ceremony. It's very it never doesn't happen, and it's very moving and very powerful. And you throw, it's like there's a fire, and you just throw all of the things that you're sorry that you did into this huge fire that with all the other people in the community. It's a very just regurgitating almost ceremony. You just throw it all out. And you really do feel cleansed afterwards. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So somebody asked, I feel so bad about stealing when I was younger. I cannot make amends to those I hurt. I might be able to stop the stealing mind at least somewhat, but not the guilt. Should I continue to dwell on this guilt? It's painful.
No, the guilt does nothing. You, in fact, if you can just drop it altogether, it doesn't do you any good, and it doesn't do anybody any good. And one way you can stop it is just literally by training yourself. This is that one where if you have in your pocket the opposite positive thought, that as soon as you recognize, as soon as you see yourself going on a guilt trip of your own making, you substitute the opposite positive thought. I am going to be a ryokan disciple and open my heart to all beings without exception. A sentence like that every time you feel guilty. And I think that will help you. But for sure, guilt doesn't have a place in this picture. And it's true that you can't go back and make amends in this situation, but you can make amends mentally, and you can practice Zazen so that you don't continue harming things, at least for that time. Actually, Zazen changes your fascia, and it changes your cells, and it changes these places where our karma persists. That's all.
So somebody shared, I steal time on the clock at work. This is something I've always felt justified, and under the conditions of capitalism, it seems like there are so many legal forms of stealing, like poverty wages. But I also see how that line of thinking is very abstract. I also see how my actions of stealing time creates discomfort and bad feelings if I look closely in my life. I wonder if you could speak to how this line of thinking is incorrect or too egocentric.
Yes. I mean, it's wonderful that you see it this clearly, first of all, because no change happens without acknowledging that there's something that needs changing. And in this case, you're right. It is stealing. It's stealing from your employer who's paying you to do something other than wasting the time. No matter what, you need to stop that for yourself, for your own well-being and your own conscience and your own karma. You need to stop that, which might even mean changing your job. You're basically creating a situation for yourself of not well-being, of unwell-being. And so just for your own well-being's sake, if you could find another way to use time that otherwise, in other words, if you don't have enough to do, and you dread being told something else that's boring to do, maybe there's some other way you could make yourself useful at your work that would inspire you, that you actually would be interested in. And you could offer that. You could offer that to the situation. No matter what, though, not to continue, because that is stealing time. It's taking something under auspices that weren't agreed upon. That's all.
Gail, so next question we have is, can you give some hints as to why? Give me a second, please. Sorry. So can you give some hints as to why stealing from the Sangha would be worse than even killing or harming the Sangha in any other way?
Well, of course, I've thought about that in preparation for this talk. And the only thing that came to me was that the intense selfishness of it, that it's just cold-hearted, taking property is just 100% selfish, whereas the other, I'm not saying the killing is okay, but I'm just saying that this is entirely my own guess, because I had the same question, of course. But the only thing that occurred to me is that there's a kind of cold-heartedness to it, that killing your father, you must at least feel passionately rightful in doing that, even though it's not rightful. Whereas there's no, how passionate could you feel about taking an object from the Sangha, from the Sangha's property? Just seems more selfish to me. And I'm just guessing here. I really don't know the answer to your question. I have the same question. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question is, I'd like to try practicing the 5 lay precepts, but I can't imagine not drinking or smoking weed. They calm me down. Why is that part so important?
There's an old adage, you can't be in a boat and go in two directions at the same time. And Buddhist practice is about consciousness. And intoxicants of any kind are about unconsciousness. So you can't be in the boat and go both directions. So it's basically undoing what you're doing in trying to practice any form of Buddhism, really, or any form of consciousness raising, actually, mindfulness. It might be useful for you to inquire why you need that much calming down in the first place. Why is your life such that it requires intoxicants? And if it's stress, you might want to seriously look at your life and lower the stress, because stress creates illness. And there's no reason why, as a intelligent and responsible adult, you wouldn't want to create a life where that was at a minimum and you didn't need external substances to do this for you. That's all.
So the next question is, can you say more about the five lay precepts?
Yes. Before taking the Bodhisattva precepts formally, actually, you should already be practicing and already know them through and through with your whole body and mind. So by the time you consider, quote, taking the Bodhisattva precepts, you should already have them, actually. There isn't any taking. The ceremony serves as a celebration and acknowledging that you already have them. And it does this publicly, but you're not getting anything. Taking the five lay precepts, so to speak, kneading them into your life is tremendously beneficial in itself, and also the first step to making an even larger commitment to yourself, which would be the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony, where you take the vows of these 16 precepts. So it's basically like a starter. It's like this. It's like testing, trying on how would it be to live by a vow, and then these vows are laid out for you. The five. They're actually five of the 10. And you get to watch yourself as you practice. And then, of course, the practice in itself practices itself. And then you, as the bystander, can see what you think. Assess whether it's helpful or not. Maybe it's not helpful. You know, in Zen especially, clinging or holding on to anything, especially the Dharma as a set of rules, for example, we take refuge in the Dharma, but we don't cling to it as if it were a rigid set of ways to behave. Nothing is set in stone in Buddhism. Nothing. Even the idea of the Buddha, there's nothing set in stone, and there's nothing that we cling to. Somebody earlier this morning that I was counseling used the word calcified about her extended family, and holding on to spiritual prohibitions can become calcified behavior, and that's entirely the opposite of the spirit of Zen. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So the last question we have is, the fact that our opinions and thoughts are deeply entangled in our muscles, bones, cells, tissues, and nerves, is this why habits are so hard to get rid of?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's why our thoughts even and responses are so confused. Like the story I told you about, to this day, there's this instinct, if I see something on the street or sidewalk, let's say, you know, the instinct to pick it up, to take it. I don't know where that comes from. But without this understanding of it comes from my nervous system and my tissue and my cells and bones, from other times when I did it all the time without even thinking. If it's not for that, it would be crazy. It would just be crazy. It makes so little sense that that's the only way I can make sense out of it. So yes, I think that has a lot to do with our habits. And in another talk, I did explain how you can lay down new neural pathways. And I guess I'm saying that even the new neural pathways only go so far. There's still that deep embedded, you know, in our Alaya consciousness, the deep embedded. But Zazen cleans that consciousness. Zazen actually cleans the Alaya consciousness, and that's one benefit. But we don't want to do Zazen for too many benefits. We just want to do Zazen, or we just want to allow, give Zazen the opportunity to practice itself through us as much as possible. Thank you so much for being here. And I'll meet you again next week. Bye-bye.